The Bucket List.
I've got no problems with spiders, but I do get that if you're like my husband, you may not be a particular fan of them. But spider silk is a pretty interesting material, and it might surprise you just how long it takes to get enough of it so that you can actually make a textile out of it, or how you would even harvest silk from a spider. Well, someone who knows a bit about doing that is Nicholas Godley, and he's an entrepreneur who, alongside artist Simon Piers, created some amazing garments purely from spider silk. And it all started on Madagascar, an island nation off the southeast coast of Africa. Now, I spoke to Nicholas via Skype, and he told me how this adventure into spider silk first began.
When I first heard about the idea of milking a spider, which was actually, you know, it came from Simon. He had like a mechanical piece in his office, and we were friends, and we lived in different towns, and I used to visit him, and I used to say, and he's a textile expert and creates some of the most amazing textiles in the world. And I said, well, what is this machine part? And he's like, oh, you'll never guess. It's the mechanical part for a machine that would milk a spider. And I thought, for venom, I had no, you know, to me, it sounded like the strangest thing. And then he told me about this French priest who had been in Madagascar in the 19th century, who had spent 10 years, you know, collecting spiders. And they made the awnings of this bed. And it was Madagascar's contribution to the World Expo in 1900, when people, like, you know, presented like the automobile. Every country would contribute something. And Madagascar's contribution was, you know, a spider silk bed. And he had spent 10 years doing this. And Simon had archived this, and he had done the historical research. You know, I'd never heard about this priest who had done this. And so my first reaction, you know, was, is it for venom? And he's like, no. And then I said, well, why aren't you doing it? And he said, well, it's, you know, it's a bit crazy to do something like this. And so, you know, whenever I'd visit him, I'd always ask him, I'd say, Simon, you know, what's up with the spiders? Are you doing it? And, you know, he was like, no. And so I said, well, what if we tried to do it together? And I had a factory on the coast. We used to make handbags that we used to sell in the U.S. So I closed that up, and I moved my staff to the capital. And, you know, we built the first machine, and, you know, it worked. And we figured out how to harness the spiders, and, you know, 24 spiders with their bellies sticking out, their abdomens. And we were able to get silk out of all of them. And, you know, we turned this thing. It's, you know, it's all, you know, mechanical. There's nothing electric, you know. And we had sort of clues on what this guy had done, but all of them were misleading. And the drawings that we saw were wrong. So we actually had to, you know, invent it ourselves, and it worked. And then the second thing was, you know, once you get silk, you realize then you need a lot of spiders. I mean, to make a tie, you probably would need, you know, 30,000 spiders. And, you know, then it became a question of, where do you find all these spiders, and how do you bring them alive? And so this thing took on a life of its own. And, you know, the thing was, and Simon's right, I could see why he never did it. You know, you needed a lot of perseverance and a lot of patience to see it through. And we worked with the golden orb, which is you get them in Australia, you get them in the subtropical belt, Malaysia, you know, the orb weavers, and they have a natural gold thread. They're beautiful spiders. They bite. You know, if you get bitten, it's like a bee sting. It's not Australia venom deadly, but it's not pleasant either. And getting people to work with spiders, because they get bitten all day long, you know, they have to harness them, and then they have to release them. So they're in contact with the spiders, and the spiders obviously are not, you know, probably very happy to be there. So they'll bite, and they're big, and they're all females. So
spiders do get grumpy when you're trying to harness silk.
Absolutely, they're grumpy. They'd rather be in their webs. I mean, you know, 20 minutes later, you know, we release them back into nature. So I think anything in the natural world, any contact with humans are, you know, it's going to be a challenge. So, and for the humans, it was the issue of getting bitten. You can't use gloves. You know, you have to be very delicate because you don't want to harm the spiders. And you have to fit them into an individual harness, which means that you have to separate the legs. You have to place them in there. And you can't hurt them, because we eventually go back and we milk them again after a month or two, once they've woven, you know, new webs, and they're able to produce more silk. So it's a renewable resource in a way. But getting people, you know, who are not freaked out about spiders, and I'm scared of spiders. So just finding people who are willing to do this, Rihanna, was a challenge, I can tell you that. And I think it's normal that anybody would not want to get bitten. And so what we found was that the people who have ended up working with us are people that have very, very quick fingers. They don't get bitten a lot, and they're very delicate. They have a tactile ability to move their fingers quickly. When the spiders arrive in the morning, you know, by the thousands, we open these boxes that they bring them in. And they're just really fast at sort of picking them up one by one and putting them in harnesses without getting bitten. All of these were challenges. And then figuring out a system where we could, you know, collect eventually thousands of spiders a day. The ladies that worked for us, you know, end up hiring other people because we paid by the spider as well. And we paid enough so that it was worth their while to collect a lot of spiders. And so they all have, you know, other people that collect for them. And over time, over the years, you know, they learn how to milk the spiders better so they get a better yield. You know, it's a, you know, there's a learning curve, if you will, for the whole process. So I can see why nobody had done it since the 19th century, because to do it on a scale where you have enough silk to do anything worthwhile, you know, if you were to do it, let's say in Malaysia or in an area where you could find a lot of these, it would always be, you know, a challenge. So, and there was no obvious, you know, remunerative benefit at the outset. And it's like, you know, okay, so, you know, we're investing in this, but what are we going to, you know, are we ever going to make any money? Can we commercialize this? You know, how do you find a pathway to make money? And that's also been, you know, a huge challenge, you know, but it was worth doing, because I think, you know, in life you see things like this and you say, if you never try it, you'll never know. And we were in a position where we were in Madagascar. We did have the expertise. We already had companies. We already had employees. We knew how to work in the country for many, many years. And so it was something that, in the end, I think, you know, was worthwhile. And the reception we got from the museums that we exhibited and getting to talk to people and just, you know, showing people what an amazing material this is was in some ways, you know, a reward unto itself.
Nicholas, I mean, did you and Simon Pierce, your creative partner, the person you worked with on this particular project, I mean, did you realize at the time that you were creating the largest piece of spider silk cloth in the world?
Yes. And that was very much the intention from the beginning. It didn't matter, Rihanna, if it would take 3 years, 5 years, 10 years or 20 years. The idea was to get to a million spiders, because I felt that if we're going to go through this, through all of this work, we should do something that's impressive and that'll get people's attention. And, you know, in a way that establishes something of significance and wonder, you know, because these are wonderful creatures and they produce a wonderful, incredible, in fact, material. So we aimed for that number and we didn't know how long it would take us. And, you know, it did take 5 years to make the textile and almost 4 years to do the cape. So as time went on, we got better at what we were doing and we could get more silk from fewer spiders. But that took years, Rihanna. It wasn't something that happened overnight.
This is ABC Radio. I'm Rihanna Patrick and Nicholas Godley is my guest. He's an entrepreneur and co-creator of the Spider Silk Cape. So how robust is spider silk, Nicholas?
Well, you know, six times the tensile strength of steel, you know, it stretches to 150% of its weight. And not just the strength of the material, but the, you know, it's got all these amazing properties. For example, in medicine, the biocompatibility of spider silk and the human body are unrivaled. There is a hospital in Germany, for example, that have created scaffolds to regenerate nerves using spider silk, and they have their own spiders. This is the University of the Medical School in Hanover, Germany. They've done, you know, incredible work with spider silk, and they've been able to basically lengthen the amount of nerve regeneration in a body. So let's say 20 centimeters was the length that you could do under current medical practice. They've been able to extend that to 2 meters. And the biocompatibility. So once you create the scaffold with spider silk, because the body absorbs the silk and it's also got natural antibacterial properties on it. So you don't have to sterilize it. You know, you can regrow, you know, cells on spider silk in a way which you can do with no other material. So, you know, a lot of the money is going into what they call artificial spider silk. And there are, you know, a number of companies around the world that are trying to reproduce the strength and the technological, you know, similarities of the silk. But to me, the most interesting aspects of it are in the medical field and what it can do. And there have been examples, again, throughout history of people using spider silk in the Civil War in America, you know, battle wound dressings. The Romans used it for battle wound dressings. Spider silk is incredible. So anytime you see spider silk, I think, you know, don't just look at the strength of it, but look at the biocompatibility that it has. And this is, you know, the product of 300 million years of evolution. You know, we still to this day do not know how spiders produce silk. We don't know how the spinnerets make the silk. We don't know how the interaction with oxygen works in any definitive way. And like I said, you know, there are several companies that have tried to mimic it. And they make claims that it's spider silk when in fact it's not. It's, you know, there are certain chemical similarities. But, you know, 300 million years, you know, a lab does not make. even though it's similar, it's not the same. And it's not certainly a natural product. It doesn't have natural antibacterial properties. You know, it's different.
Nicholas, this whole project sounds like it's been a bit of a journey and a learning journey at that. I mean, how do you care for a garment made of spider silk?
You just don't get it wet, you know. If you wet spider silk, if it's not treated, and we'd never treated anything that we made, it'll shrink. So if you wore a spider silk cape and somebody threw a bucket of water on it, presumably it would, like an anaconda, it would asphyxiate you. And we've tried it on small samples. It's quite amazing. It's a delayed effect, like in 2 minutes, it completely shrinks. And it's really, really strong. So if you were wearing the cape and it was fastened onto you, I'd hate to see what would happen. Because once it starts shrinking, it's incredibly strong. Nothing can stop that process. But yeah, you know, you have to preserve them. But the color, the golden color, it never fades, even with sunlight. And we know this because we had pieces of small samples, you know, which sat in a window that got sun for 2 years, and it never lost any of its color. Unlike a dyed pigment on a cotton shirt or a silk shirt that's been dyed, it never loses its color. There are good ways to care for it. And it's incredibly soft, by the way. That was another revelation when we had enough silk to hold in our hands, you know, sort of a big bunch, if you will, of thread. It was unbelievable. It's so light and soft. It doesn't feel like anything I'd felt, not like silk or angora or anything. It's got sort of just a hint of stickiness when you touch an individual strand. It'll cling to your finger, but it's unbelievably soft. It's an incredibly luxurious, you know, tactile experience.
Is it true that it's almost an invisible, like it feels as though it's not there?
It is. That's exactly right. It feels like it's not there. And it sort of floats, because that's how they make webs. I mean, you know, when you look at a 10 meter span, you know, you think, you know, how did it get from one tree to the next? It's got to fly somehow. And so that's where the lightness and the material comes from. Even though it's incredibly strong, it also has to, you know, get from, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 meters across.
Can you talk me through the process of what it was to get the spider silk into a form that you could then make the cape out of? I mean, what were the time spans between the first process of that to then actually cutting out your cape?
Well, you get 24 strands of spider thread from the machine, and that sounds like a lot. It's not. It's an incredibly small piece of thread. And then you can double it. You can double it to 48 strands, 72 strands, and so on and so forth. And the thicker you go, changes its luster. So if you're weaving it and you have 960 strands of silk, it gives it and we did this on the cape, all the embroidery was done with a much thicker thread. And it gives it a, you know, three-dimensional look, even though it's exactly the same material. So basically, you take the thread and you spool it and you decide what thickness you want. And, you know, you can then put it in a loom to, you know, a mechanical loom. And you can make, you know, straight fabric like sheets. Or you can keep making it thicker and thicker and thicker and doubling it and doubling it. And then, you know, you throw the thread and then you can get whatever thickness and up until rope if you wanted to. Working it is not like working cotton or silk or anything else. And, you know, on the loom, it sort of pings like a guitar and reacts very differently.
Nicholas, what was that day like when you started cutting the cape out? Was it a nervous moment? I would never, I don't think, want to cut something that had taken a number of years to put together in the first place.
You're absolutely right. No, it was nerve-wracking. And, you know, just every step of the way was, you know, there was no, you don't get a second chance, basically. And so you've got to be, you know, not just careful, but you have to, you know, plan well ahead in advance every step of the way. Absolutely. And you still don't know until the very end what it's going to look like and if it's going to work. So, you know, we actually had no guarantees that it would come out the way we had originally designed. You know, and just humidity in the air, Rihanna, if it's a you know, in Madagascar, it's a tropical environment. So, you know, the embroidery took 8 months. It took a team of 20 people to do the embroidery for 8 months working full time on this. And it's hot and, you know, people have sweaty hands and, you know, the changes in temperature can affect. Yeah, there are not a lot of guarantees. And I think a lot of it is also experience. Once we worked on small samples, for example. We did small things first just to see how they would react and, you know, before throwing everything into these two big pieces.
I'm Rhianna Patrick. This is ABC Radio and my guest is Nicholas Godley. He is an entrepreneur and co-creator of the Spider Silk Cape. Nicholas, is it true that your grandmother was born in Madagascar?
She was, actually. Yes, she was Greek. She was born there and I had heard that. I'd heard about Madagascar growing up and I thought I would never, ever go there. But I ended up going there, and she had died by the time I went there. But she had always told me stories of Madagascar, and it was one of these, you know, mysterious places I never thought I would ever go to, and I ended up going there and staying there for way longer than I probably should have.
Once you compared the stories of what your grandmother had told you and then you went there, what was the reality like?
When I went there, Madagascar was like North Korea, and they had a little red book. I mean, they went, you know, Marxist, Leninist, Stalinist, North Korean. They went from 1975 to 1990 when I went there. I went there in 91 for the first time. You know, they had basically expelled all the Europeans. They reclaimed, if you will, you know, their country for themselves. It had mixed results, and I think there was a real push to open up the country to foreign investment. And when I went there, it was under those conditions that I invested, because you could have a free trade zone company. You could, you know, import without paying taxes for 15 years. There were incentives there. It was incredibly poor. In terms of how I compared, my grandmother was there, you know, at a time when Madagascar was, you know, was still very basic, if you will, but it was under French colonial rule. So it was a very different place. I mean, the rules were different. Her relationship to the country was very different from mine. So her experience, you know, would have been very different from mine as well. Having said that, when her father left, and her father was the honorary Greek consul in Madagascar, you know, they made a fortune. They owned like the main supermarket in the island. I mean, they were wealthy. They owned one of 10 cars in Athens when they went. There were 10 vehicles in Greece, and they owned one of them. They had done really well. When I went to Madagascar, they were struggling. I think, you know, it's a very poor country. Population growth is insane. I mean, one of the highest fertility rates in the world. Diminishing natural resources, which is, you know, a huge problem for the country. I'd never seen a place like that, you know. It's very, very poor, Rhianna. And I thought, you know, if there's a way to help, it's by creating employment. And yeah, the incentives were there, but you know, you still have to live there and you still have to deal with a lot of challenges. You know, the roads are terrible. There's no healthcare system. You know, you take, you know, enormous personal risks, I think, to be there. And, you know, I was rewarded because I was able to work with amazing people and still do. In fact, we still milk spiders. We still have a workshop. We haven't stopped. This is still an ongoing concern. And, you know, if you work right and are able to find the right people to work with, I think you can, you know, you can do well.
So, Nicholas, since this spider silk journey and where it's taking you, I mean, have you been surprised at just where this has gone and how many people have heard about what you and Simon have created across the world?
Well, the Australian Museum being one of them. And again, I'm coming back to the regrets, Rhianna, of not having exhibited there. Australian Museum, if you're listening, we're happy to loan you the cape. We're doing an exhibition next year in Toronto at the Royal Ontario. And I think it's somehow linked to this Australian Museum exhibit from 2012. I think some of the objects are traveling are going to be in the Toronto exhibition. So there is a link. It's been incredible reaction, reception. I think, you know, when you look at the art world and, you know, and I'm not from that world, but this was something that brought amazement to, you know, 11-year-old children to, you know, the most sophisticated sort of art critics, if you will. It appealed to such a broad range of different people. And it brought people, I think, to museums that may never have gone to museums. I remember when we had the exhibit at the V&A, at the Victoria and Albert in London, you know, people traveled from like Birmingham and other parts of England to see this. And that was, you know, that was also, you know, incredibly rewarding in some ways, because I don't think that they had seen anything like it, and they hadn't. And so that was a wonderful thing, you know, to see. And just what appeals to a 9-year-old and, you know, the most vicious art critic in London, you know, equally. So this is one of those things that was able, you know, in a way to do that.
And you mentioned that you live between a number of different places at the moment, Nicholas, but what are you doing and where has your journey taken you after this Spider Silk project?
The journey's not over, Rihanna. Don't listen. We're patient like spiders. You know, we can wait in our webs for years. Nobody knew we were doing this until we arrived with an enormously beautiful textile. And, you know, years later, we made a cape. And so the journey is ongoing. And I think the next project that you'll see from us will be equally as extraordinary, very different. We're partnering possibly with a company in the automotive sector and working on something in that field that will also, I think, you know, blow people away. So no, we haven't stopped and we haven't rested. We're continuously looking for new opportunities and new uses, really. I mean, I don't think we want to repeat what we've done. The idea of the textile was to honor Madagascar. It's a, you know, it's based on the traditional Malagasy weavings. So that was the first large piece that we did. The second priority for us was to create something wearable. And that's why we decided to make a cape. The idea of being enveloped with silk, like a bug is enveloped with silk when it's caught by a spider. So everything had a reason. And doing something, this might be possibly a bit more commercial, obviously, because it's more of a commercial project, but it'll have, you know, it'll also, you know, be quite different. And I think it'll amaze people, you know, equally as well, and in a different way, possibly, too. So no, we're like I said, we're still working, and hopefully if I can continue going, I'll never stop. And I'm not going to lose the expertise that we've gained over the last, you know, almost 15 years now, if we can avoid doing that.
That's Nicholas Godley, entrepreneur and co-creator of the Spider Silk Cape, talking to me there via Skype from New York. And if you've never seen a spider silk cape made from the spider silk of a golden orb spider, then I have posted a video of that amazing cape if you want to take a closer look at it at facebook.com/abcri, which is just facebook.com/abcri, and you can find it there. And Nicholas and Simon must have patience. I don't think I could silk about a million spiders and then wait a number of years before I created a cape. And as you heard there, I mean, spider silk, not really the best to wear in wet weather. It may go horribly pear-shaped, as they say. You may end up feeling as though you have been taken by a spider, that you may become the spider's food. But interesting nonetheless, and you really have to see that amazing video of that spider silk cape, because it is just absolutely beautiful.